Pseudopod, episode 172, December 11th, 2009. This week's story, The Dude Who Collected Lovecraft by Nick Mamatas and Tim Pratt. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. This week's story comes to us from two of the best writers working today, Nick Mamatas and Tim Pratt. Nick is the author of two novels and a horde of short stories, three of which, this one included, were nominated for Stoker Awards. He's also the editor of Haikasoru, an imprint dedicated to bringing the best in Japanese science fiction to a Western audience. If you've not read their books, I'd recommend you do so. Lord of the Sands of Time is, frankly, a classic. Tim Pratt, meanwhile, won a Hugo Award for his short fiction, has appeared in Best American Short Stories, and is also the author of the Marlon Mason series of urban fantasy novels. Tim's a regular at Drabblecast as well, so if you like this, make sure you check out his work there. Your narrator this week is Jaron Cohen of supersonicspots.com. So, make sure your collection is ready for display and valuation, because Nick and Tim have a story for you, and they promise you it's true.
The Dude Who Collected Lovecraft by Nick Mamatas and Tim Pratt. I drove a brand new rental car I couldn't afford, next year's model, so in a way, it was a car from the future. From the Amherst Amtrak stop, and into the Vermont countryside, which was just as picturesque as all the calendar photos had led me to expect. The Green Mountains flared with red and gold from the changing leaves of fall. I had to stop a couple of times in some ebullient little towns, first for gas, and later to use the toilet. And while everyone was polite, talkative even, I felt a few stares. I don't get a lot of black people around here. Some of these towns, South Shaftesbury and Shaftesbury, East Arlington and then Arlington, as if having two stoplights or a three-block-long main drag were enough to fission a town into two, were positively 19th century. My cell phone didn't work. They sold maple syrup by the gallon in even the dumpiest gas stations. I thought about the brittle old letters in my briefcase, which included, among genial advice on writing and cranky complaints about publishers, a few passages of deep loathing about the niggers and immigrants who fester and shamble in the slums of our fallen cities. Ah, Lovecraft. I always wondered how my great-grandfather's letters back to him might have read. I doubted if old Kavanaugh Payne ever told his idol that he was a miscegenator himself. Three generations later, I was fresh out of white-skin privilege myself, but I had enough of Kavanaugh's legacy to clear all my debts, assuming I could ever find the isolated country house where this collector lived. The hand-drawn map Fremjin had mailed me was crude and obviously not to scale, so it was a little like following a treasure map made by a pirate with a spatial perception disorder. I tried to find better directions online, but none of the map sites even recognized the name of the street he lived on, Goudineau Road. I understood why when, as late afternoon shaded into evening, I found his signless dirt road surrounded by maple and pine trees. The only marker by the rutted track was a squat statue carved out of some black marble. The figure looked like the offspring of a toad and a jellyfish, wearing a weathered white stone crown. The collector had drawn a little picture of the stone road marker on my map. I'd assumed it was a childish scrawl, but in truth it wasn't a bad likeness. It wasn't a bad likeness of a bad likeness, anyway. After bumping down the road, dotted with even more indescribable statues, for about 5 minutes, I found the house, a three-story wood monstrosity, with a vast front porch wrapped around at least three sides, and a carriage house sagging down into itself off to one side. Whatever color these buildings had once been, the boards had faded to a sort of stony gray, and they both looked on the verge of disintegration, trees pressing in close, eager to take back the land. I parked the car and got out, and in the silence of dusk, the slamming car door was the loudest thing I'd ever heard. I approached the house, with its windows all blinded by curtains, and went up the paint-flecked steps to the porch, where a swing hung, broken from one chain. This wasn't promising. I'd been assured that this collector was wealthy, but he didn't look rich from here. Maybe I'd turned down the wrong road and was about to be attacked by some backroads cannibal who wore the skin of his victims as an apron. Well, probably not. I knocked on the solid wooden door.
"Who's there?"
shouted a voice from inside, so quickly he must have been standing right there, waiting. That's when I noticed the peephole set in the door, which seemed like an odd touch for an old country house. "It's Jim Payne," I said, and waited. No response. "I called you about the letters?" Still no reply. I'm Kavanaugh Payne's great-grandson?
I've seen pictures of Payne, and I can't say I say much resemblance,
came the reply from behind the door in a querulous Green Mountain accent. Say and see sounded almost identical. I gritted my teeth and made it look like a smile. Grandma always said I looked just like him. There's no particular reason to take crap from some crazy old kook, money or not. I was ready to walk. I thought I heard a grunt from behind the door, and then it opened. And I got my first look at the man who collected Lovecraft.
Kavanaugh, your letter of the 10th and the enclosed materials reached me just in the nick of time. Bravo. I have been having, as Clark Ashton had mentioned to you, a quite difficult time with the latest yarn. It's already somewhat of a ramble, but I cannot help but complete it now, as there are few other opportunities in the offing for old Grandpa. It was a mistake coming to New York, I must admit now. While the valleys of the financial district are grand, and the subtle corners and hints of twisting Dutch road still remain and reverberate with the sort of classical detail I love, the world of commerce is beyond me. I've written several lengthy letters of introduction to various concerns, both in publishing and in workaday worlds of commodities trading, but haven't yet received so much as a social card with a hastily scribbled telephone exchange under the name of a Dean or a Hathaway beneath it. Not that such a number would be possible for me to reach. The horrid tenement in which I find myself is without a telephone or any of the other amenities of the modern world, or graces of the world I'm afraid has left us forever. I have decided to take a hold of one end of that old writer's saw, write what one knows, and with my latest story I hope to write a truly devilish, nasty bit of business connecting the rites and rituals of the Yezdi, which you have so readily and thoughtfully transcribed for me. Of all of this medieval superstition and thaumaturgy, I know little, but of New York, I am afraid I'm learning rather too much. The gangs of young loafers and evil-looking foreigners who traipse down the alleyways by the horde are so disconcerting to me, I cannot help but see them whenever I close my eyes. Oh, for the fabled night gaunts of old, at least fantastical terrors are ephemeral, while this city, full of swarthy Latins and darky brutes, with of course old Shylock himself sitting and preening atop the twisted mass of bodies, is as solid as granite. The devolutionary social processes I espied in Providence have bloomed like fecund and fetid lichen here, clinging and moldy to the once grand thoroughfares and edifices of Gotham. I fear for our future, Kavanaugh. I fear for the destiny of a Nubian America. On my walks, I've stumbled upon perhaps the perfect setting for this new story. The very name of the neighborhood is evocative. Red Hook. It is New York in microcosm. The streets are lined with old Dutch history. Dykeman, Van Brunt. Indeed, even the hook is an anglicization of hoke, or point. And yet the peninsula is aswarm with the most bestial of immigrants and workingmen, lured to the area by the swampish go-ons and the day labor of the bustling piers. Who knows what eldritch evils can be hidden in the steel bellies of the ships and brought to bear by the husky stevedore and his own bailing hook? Sounds like a yarn I could, I hope, market to the pulps. Your grandpa, I'm afraid, is down to his last 3 tins of mackerel and beans, and if no remittances are forthcoming, perhaps my next letter to you will be written in a truly skeletal hand, directed only by the impulses of a madman in a garret. Wouldn't that be a doozy? Thank you again, both humbly and gratefully I am, as always, old Gramps Theobald, H.P.L.
Fremjin was an old white dude, and he wore a brown suit jacket with a red bow tie. I didn't know if he dressed up special for me or if he always knocked around the house like this, but he made me feel underdressed. The letters in my briefcase were like a passport into a strange country. I don't know what I expected. I knew he was a collector, but when I think of guys who collect sci-fi and fantasy crap, I don't imagine museum-quality stuff. I think fat nerd. A beard sprinkled with Cheeto dust. A filthy room full of porn DVDs, half-cannibalized computers, and ancient Chinese takeout. The imperious tisk of worst Lovecraft letter ever, followed by, I hoped, a sack of money anyway. But this dude's living room didn't even look like a place where someone lived, let alone something from a comic book convention. It was more like a boutique. There were glass cases, discreetly lit, holding manuscript pages, old magazines, letters, and even some objects, a handkerchief, one shoe, a couple of pens, all of which I assumed had touched the extremities of Mr. Lovecraft himself. There were bookshelves fronted with glass holding hundreds of volumes. More bizarrely, there were a few little pedestals topped with domes of glass, supporting items of obscure function. I saw a metal cylinder under one dome, a big glass jar with something floating in murky fluid under another, and a third just looked like a profusion of copper tubing wound around some kind of helmet or headdress. There were tiny handwritten index cards inside each case and under each dome, but Fremjin didn't give me time to browse.
"Sit, sit,"
he said, and I settled onto one of the two ancient wingback chairs, the velvet upholstery emitting a little puff of dust when I sat. He sat in the chair's twin, facing me, his eyes squinting and intense. There was a low table between us set with a funny-looking clay tea kettle and some lumpy cups and bumpy saucers that looked like they'd been made in a pottery class for the mentally ill. I started to open the briefcase, figuring he wanted to get this over with, but then he spoke abruptly.
"You say you're from Red Hook, in Bracklin?"
"That's right." He mulled that over.
"You know Lovecraft wrote a story about that place?"
"Sure. The Red Hook Horror, or something like that." I knew the title wasn't right, but something made me want to mess with this guy a little. He didn't seem fazed, though.
"The Horror at Red Hook, yes. Lovecraft himself didn't think much of the story. Thought it was too rambling, but am rather fond of it. Many of Lovecraft's fictions are outlandish. Time-traveling aliens, winged creatures that fly through the vides of space, cities of fungi. But the story of Red Hawk always seemed more plausible to me. That immigrants to our shores would bring with them dark rituals from their homelands and unleash horrors upon an unexpected city. Lovecraft lived in New York for a time. He knew the alleyways and corners and pairs more intimately than he wished. And he saw the old settlers being pushed aside by the newcomers with their strange and sacrative ways."
"Have you ever been to Red Hook?" I interrupted.
"Only in my mind's eye,"
he said, and sounded like he thought it was just as good as a visit in person.
"Has it changed much since Lovecraft's day? Are there still crumbling red brick buildings, the oppressive streets, the air of imminent decay?"
I considered. I wanted to call this guy a moron, but our deal wasn't done yet. I pay $1,600 a month for a studio apartment. They're also building the world's largest IKEA in Red Hook, so that's pretty scary. Look, I've got the letters Lovecraft wrote to Kavanaugh."
"Your ancestor wasn't much of a writer, really,"
Fremjin mused.
"His fiction, I mean. He actually has some of the letters he wrote to Lovecraft, and they're better. More enthusiastic, less imitative. In his fiction, he write about Vermont and New Hampshire like a man who'd never been there, never left the city of his birth. His stories of odd civilizations on forgotten continents were more plausible. Have you read Planet of the Phantasm? The swirling abyssal kale echoed across a verdant plains of Pramatat, raising snake-tailed shrine plants from their slumber, lidless amber piles peering forth to—"
"Can't say I'm a fan of the old man's work myself," I stepped in. "I like crime stories. Nothing seemed to needle this guy."
"But you're one of his blood, aren't you? However much that blood has been diluted, the past lives on all around us. You're connected to Kavanaugh, and draw him to a different time. Henley and I blink in the past on a cosmic scale, of course. But in Yaman terms, three generations is a vast and nearly insurmountable gulf. Don't you think?"
"Yes, yes I do." This guy was not going to be rushed, but at least I could avoid offering up a conversational opening.
"Drink with me?"
He picked up the teacup in front of him, slurped it, made a contented face, and gestured to the kettle. I poured a little into my own cup, just enough to be polite, and took a sip. It was like drinking dirty river water.
"Brewed from local labs,"
the guy said, nodding.
"I grow them myself."
"Delicious," I said, after I managed to swallow a second mouthful. "And I thank you for your hospitality, but I'd like to get out of here before too late."
"Indulge an old man?"
He smiled, and any doubt I had about his faculties disappeared. That was a knowing smile, and whatever he was doing it on purpose.
"You can learn a lot from the past, young man.
The things in this room, they are valuable. Some are even priceless. But they are not the heart of my collection. Would you come upstairs with me to see some of my more interesting items? I get so few visitors, and the things I have to show you might change your perspective.
Don't piss off the golden goose, I thought. Sure, I guess I could take a quick look, I said, praying this wasn't some kind of sex thing. I left the briefcase with the letters by the chair and followed him up the narrow, tilting stairway, the walls lined with photographs so dusty their subjects were impossible to discern. The stairs opened into a big room that must have taken up the entire upper floor. There were literally thousands of newspapers stacked along the walls and into the center of the room, forming stumpy corridors. The squeeze made all that tighter due to heaps of junk spilling off rickety card tables and bowed folding chairs. I took about 2 steps into the room and things started to get woozy and swirly and vague. The old dude just stood there grinning as I swayed and stumbled. Shit, I said, or something equally articulate. But my thoughts were clear. Not a sex thing. A drug is tea and murder 'em thing. There was no place to fall.
Kavanaugh. Greetings, O left hand of young Belknap. I was quite pleased to show you about Providence this past fortnight, being nonetheless pleased to have finally returned to the seat of my ancestors, and hope that one day you'll return for another visit when you're not feeling quite so poorly. One for the commonplace book strikes me just now. Penfriend spends a warm summer day meeting in the flesh with a penfriend, and returns home via locomotive only to be greeted by a letter from the old boy's spinster aunt, sending regrets and condolences. Apologies for opening and reading your correspondence with my Samuel, but you must know that he passed of tuberculosis a month gone by. I'll likely not do anything with it. Now that it's down on paper, the idea rather smacks of Victoriana. No possibility of tightening coils of horror, reaching out and gradually dragging the reader in. I want tremendously to pen another tale, but even this letter is being written piecemeal between snatches of revisionary work and long nights of astronomical observation. An aurora has visited Providence, as it does at the rarest of intervals, and I have taken to camping out under the blankets in subarctic weather to observe this most cryptical of sky effects. A very few degrees of latitude makes all the difference when it comes to an auroral perception, so I am sure you have in your new Green Mountain home auroras with a frequency beyond all Rhode Island standards. Wandry speaks of a recent trip home. You would do well to shoe him some of your weird fiction, for he is among the most discerning and erudite of our band of enthusiasts, and has frequently hinted that he may dare to launch a magazine of weird new fiction of his own. Your obedient grandsire, Necropolis.
I woke up tied to a chair, and the first thing I noticed was a saline lock for putting in an IV or drawing blood. Fremjin loomed into my sight a moment later, peering at me.
Awake already! You are a strong one!
What? What? My mouth was dry, and I couldn't manage much more than that.
I just took a little blood. Barely a pint,
he said.
There's just downstairs. Cookies, too. Help yourself when I'm gone.
Motherfucker, I said, articulating as clearly as I could. Let me go. I'll fucking kill you.
I'm afraid I can't, young man. I might need more of your blood.
He turned to a table and began measuring out powders from a row of colored glass jars, pouring them into a stainless steel pot heating over a camping stove.
The recipe isn't exact, and it says the blood of direct descendants will work, but may require greater quantities. Best to keep you here and fresh.
He referred to a big old book bound in pitted black leather, running his finger along the page. He made a few more adjustments to the contents of the pot before putting the lid on it. I rocked a little in the chair, but the motion made my head spin. Whatever local herbs he'd drugged me with, they, combined with the blood loss, worked too well.
You don't know how long I've been working on this. And to have you fall into my hands, to come to my dare, it's perfect.
He picked up a sheaf of papers and shook them at me.
These are your great-grandfather's letters to Lovecraft, ya now. I bought them ages ago. I had the man's letters, the ink, the words from that time, and all I needed was a sample of the blood.
He put down the letters and began lighting candles, though his hands were shaking so badly I was afraid he'd drop the match and set the ramparts of newspapers flaming. I concentrated on breathing deeply and trying to get my equilibrium back while he set candles around the room. He moved a wooden chair to a clean spot on the floor and poured something white, salt maybe, on the floorboards, making a big circle. He poured a smaller circle of salt inside the first one, so the chair was at the center of a bullseye.
"Almost there,"
he said. He took the lid off the pot, and the smell of burning blood and weird spices made me want to retch. "What are you doing?" My voice was a lot more steady this time.
"Traveling in time, boy. Lovecraft wrote about it. Of minds traveling in time, at least. Even alien minds, transposed into human bodies and vice versa. The shadow out of time. Ye know it. Nah? Well, that's the idea. With the blade of Kavanaugh Payne's great-grandson to connect me to Hayes' body, and a letter written in Kavanaugh's own hand to connect me to a particular time, and through certain ancient rituals from priesthoods devoted to forgotten gods, I can project my mind back into Kavanaugh Payne's body, take control, and then... Oh, and then..."
I suspected that arguing with the basics of his plan was fruitless, since crazy people tend to cling to their central craziness. But I couldn't help but find the whole idea stupid, even accepting the premise. "Then what? Great-grandpa was a miserable bastard. He sold some shitty stories, knocked up great-grandma, and disappeared before the child was even born. He left all his things behind, so he probably just got murdered and dumped in a river or something. You want that life? Why?"
"It's a stepping stone,"
he said, and moved the camping stove and the pot closer to the chair, placing them carefully inside the outer salt circle. He returned to the table and picked up a yellowing letter.
"This is from Kavanaugh, in his last letter from 1928. Listen. Your offer is too kind, Grandpa. I would be delighted to visit and insist you let me stand you lunch. Perhaps we could spend the afternoon poking around those bookstores you told me so much about. You see? I didn't just write to Lovecraft. I arranged a meeting with him. And if I'm the one controlling his body when I meets Lovecraft, it should be trivial for me to get a little of the great man's blood. I won't need nearly as much as I took from ya, not when drawn from the sauce itself. Then I can simply recreate this ritual and take over Lovecraft's body. You've read The Thing on the Doorstep, no? Still, like that. As for your great-grandfather's disappearance, it only proves my venture will be successful. After I take over Lovecraft's body, Kavanaugh's corpse will be left an empty idiot husk, mindless and drooling. I'll need to get rid of it. Hence the disappearance. I'll dispose of his remains with due respect, fear not."
"Why the hell would you want Lovecraft's life? Didn't he have a fucked up marriage and die young? Wasn't he afraid of everything? Black people, brown people, the ocean, shellfish, the sky, the dark, women, everything?" I wiggled in the ropes. The knots weren't all that good. I figured I'd be able to work them loose soon. So if he wanted to keep babbling like a James Bond villain, that was fine with me. He was about 1,000 years old, so I was pretty sure I could take him, even half-drugged and down a pint of blood. Wasn't he gay? I needed this old man angry, off balance.
"But the stories,"
Fremjin said dreamily.
"If I go back to 1928 and take over Lovecraft's life, so many of the great stories will remain to be written. And I've committed them all to memory. Their publication histories. Everything. His life was so well documented, you know? With his letters. All those letters. It'll be easy to be him. And it will be Mahan that writes The Shadow Out of Time. And At the Mountains of Madness. And... But you'd never understand."
He tore the letter in his hands into little pieces and dropped them fluttering into the stinking pot, then sat down in the wooden chair in the circle of salt,
The money for the letters is in the writing desk downstairs, Payne. I don't need the letters, but take the money.
Thick smoke rose from the pot, and through some weird quirk of the room's ventilation, swirled around Fremjin and the chair without crossing the outer line of salt. Fremjin took deep breaths, and I hoped he wouldn't die of smoke inhalation before I could kick his crazy ass. I wriggled harder at the ropes and slipped my left wrist loose, then untied the other knots, though leaning down to untie my ankles made my head pound alarmingly. I stood up, waited for the swaying to settle, then headed straight for Fremjin, who was staring, blank-faced and zoned out from his chair. I stepped across the first line of salt, scuffing it with my shoe, and then a wave of horrible dizziness swept over me. Was it the smoke? More of Fremjin's homegrown knockout herbs? I stumbled and fell, sprawling across the inner salt circle. And then, I guess the only way to say it is, I traveled in time.
Nay!
The voice was clearly Fremjin's, though I didn't hear it with my ears, but ringing in my head, a syllable of pure fury. I was on a street, beside a brick building, the air cool. I leaned against a wall and groaned. It felt like somebody was banging their fists against the inside of my skull.
Mine! Mine! Mine!
Fremjin shouted. I turned my head. My neck felt funny, stiff, weird, and looked at my hands. My white, hairy-knuckled, totally unfamiliar hands. Oh, hell! I said. I don't believe this. My voice was not my voice.
You're ruining everything!
Fremjin wailed in the back of my head.
I'm on my way to see Lovecraft right now!
Nope, I said, and pushed away from the wall. I tried to take a step and nearly fell on my face because my feet were shaped wrong, and my legs were the wrong length, and altogether I felt like I was wearing a suit that was too big in some places and too tight in others. Not gonna happen. I laughed out loud. Great-grandpa had a pretty good laugh. You know, you should have read those letters I brought. The last one, from Lovecraft especially. He and Kavanaugh had a pleasant lunch, if a little awkward. I took a tentative step forward and thought I was getting the hang of operating the new body now. But I'm not letting you anywhere near that guy. Not that I actually care if you take over Lovecraft's body. One old dead white dude is as good as another, I guess. But you just shouldn't have fucked with me. I felt more pounding and poking in my head, but it wasn't too bad. Like the memory of a headache. Fremjin was inside me, retching and heavy at once, like too many pancakes. But he couldn't pull himself up my spine, into Kavanaugh's brain. He'd stolen a pint of my blood to make this spell, but when I stepped into the circle, I was full of my own blood, so I must have made a better connection. I turned down an alleyway. Just the kind of narrow passage crowded by crumbling red brick buildings, doubtlessly inhabited by swarthy immigrants, that scared the shit out of Lovecraft. So how do we get back? I said.
They will never go back. Ye have to sleep sometime. And when ye die, they will seize this body. They will find a spell to oust ye. They will succeed. I want the best too long.
We'll see. I said, and went through a doorway into what seemed to be an abandoned building, big holes bashed through the walls inside, heaps of plaster and brick and trash in the corners. I just wanted a place to hunker down and think for a little while. I wasn't eager to take over Kavanaugh's life, though he disappeared in 1928, so maybe that's what happened. What would happen? Whatever. Maybe I'd just take off and make my own way, change my name, have a new life. Kavanaugh wasn't that much older than I was. Though life expectancies in the 20s weren't so great, probably. But back here, I didn't have the debts and narrowing options I faced back home. So maybe... Something unfolded out of a dark corner. And now that I looked, that corner hurt my eyes. The angles were all wrong somehow, and the thing that stepped toward me was too big for the space in this room. It should have been all hunched over and squeezed, but it was tall. It just kept getting taller, wider, unfolding into dimensions I couldn't even comprehend. It was Squaramus, Ragoose, Noisome, Eldritch, Cyclopean. Those aren't the right words. There are no right words. But those are the best I can come up with.
Ye broke the circle!
Fremjin screamed in my mind.
Ye broke
the sea of salt, ye fool!
Ye loosed it!
The opener of the way! The dweller from the in-between! The guardian of the black and red path! It's coming for us!
Fremjin was still desperately trying to wrest control of the body away from me, so I let him. And he grabbed on, and he shoved me, and I went hurtling away from there, out of the body, just in time to see the great thing's face. Which wasn't a face, but there's no word for what it was. And it did, at least, have a mouth. Swing down and dilate, and open, and blossom, and grasp him. I woke in Fremjin's upstairs room, my head thumping. I sat up, woozy, trying to get the hang of my own body again, and scooted back out of the circle assault. Fremjin was still in the chair, drooling, body an empty vessel. His mind was back there, still, in Kavanaugh, in the belly of some unspeakable beast. I stood up, and then Fremjin lifted his face to me. His mouth opened, but what came out weren't words. Imagine shortwave radio static, loud and echoing across a depthless canyon. His eyes were wild and blank at once, crackling like an aurora. Whatever ate Fremjin had come back through the path he'd made in time. I figured I was pretty well fucked. The thing in Fremjin's body tried to stand up and fell sideways and knocked over a table and half a dozen burning candles, then kicked over the camping stove, which was still lit. There was a horrible snapping pop, and I'm pretty sure it was Fremjin's hip breaking. The thing bellowed and mewled. I remembered how hard it had been for me to walk around in Kavanaugh's body because it was so different from my own, but at least he'd been human. He'd had arms and legs and bilateral symmetry. The thing in Fremjin had come from a totally different kind of body, a thousand limbs reaching into the sixth dimension, so it could only twitch and flail as it tried to fold the curve of the world around itself just to reach me. Either the rolling camp stove or the candles caught a pile of papers on fire, and pretty soon the whole terraced array of old newspapers was burning. The thing in Fremjin's body tried to drag itself toward me, right over the flames, and it screamed, too ignorant of human limits to even know it should avoid fire. I half ran, half fell down the narrow stairs, yet I stopped by the writing desk, trying not to listen to the screaming from above, the torrent of weird syllables that didn't sound like any language I'd ever heard. I opened the drawer and there was an envelope with my name scrawled on the front. There was money in it, and though I didn't stop to count it then, I later found out it was 200 short of the price we'd agreed upon for the letters. That cheap bastard. I left the briefcase with the letters in the living room. Fremjin had paid for them, after all, and I didn't want them anymore. I didn't want to see if that last letter had changed. I went into the dark yard. The house burned behind me, looking closer to collapse with every second, and I hurried to my rental car. Pockets full of financial salvation, head full of horrors, nostrils full of smoke. I opened the car door, but before I got in, I tilted back my head and looked to the sky. Even with a flickering light from the burning roof, the stars overhead were impossibly bright and cold and indifferent. Then, on the edges of the horizon, the black of the sky shifted and crackled with coruscating waves of blue-white light. Lovecraft would have found that sky fascinating, maybe terrifying, finally. For my part, I couldn't wait to get back to a place where the light pollution was so bad you couldn't see the stars or the spaces between them at all, no matter how dark the night.
I had this whole thing about the dangers of collecting, of moving too close to the things you love and what happens when you become obsessed, what happens when you let your passions define you. Seriously, it was all done, it was all written, all ready to go. Then I looked up at the bookshelf with upwards of 50 different role-playing games and assorted supplements on it. And then I looked at the hundreds of DVDs. And then I looked at the books. Oh God, the books. So, that seemed a little hypocritical. Instead, let's talk about divides and what happens when you cross them. Nick and Tim have, very cleverly, addressed not only the lasting impact of Lovecraft, but also the difference between rural and urban, and historical and modern, all wrapped up in a story about one of the fathers of modern horror. Modern horror is, of course, very easy to decry as nothing but Saw-style gore. That's also wrong, because modern horror is both far more varied and far more insidious than that. Modern horror is on every TV, it's in every comic shop, every cinema, and it's not always wearing its usual clothes. True Blood is horror, Dexter is horror, CSI is arguably horror, and Criminal Minds and its ilk most definitely are. To To return to one of my favourite quotes and to modify it from my own ghastly, unworldly aims for a moment, modern horror is no longer about seeing something approach. It's about realising the calls really are coming from inside the house. That idea of subversion of expectation lies at the heart of this story for me. The hero views his ancestors' association with Lovecraft with none of the reverence of Fremjin, and is dismissive both of Fremjin's passion and his home. After all, he's a collector, and collectors, by definition, or at least one definition, are incomplete, forever searching for the one thing that will complete their collection, and, by extension, themselves. But where this story really flies for me is in the hero's realization of exactly what Fremjin is capable of, his resistance to it, and how easily he adapts to the new rules of his world. I've played more than enough Call of Cthulhu to have the words Sandlos tattooed onto my forebrain, but here, that just doesn't happen. Because this is the 21st century, and there has never been a time to hide from the stars, right or not, and what lives between them, to live out a life under a yellow sodium streetlight shield, and convince yourself to forget what you saw out in the backwoods. Because some collections, be they letters or memories, we have no desire to hang on to. Much like you, I'm fervently hoping to have no desire to hang on to your money. Well, not all your money, just some of it. You see, we rely on you to feed our authors, so if you liked this story, please go to pseudopod.org, click on Feed the Pod, and make an author very happy. I've just been paid for a story from another market, and believe me, there is very little more satisfying than receiving a check for something you've created. So if you can, please help us out. Oh, t-shirts as well. Poddisc.com has had a major facelift and is now the proud home of official Escape Artists t-shirts. Three designs, each with a slogan chosen by our forum members, are available, and they're all great, so go check them out. Whilst you're there, have a look at some of the other podcasts we're selling archive discs of, too. George Farab's The Geologic Podcast, in particular, is fantastic. It's a must-have for anyone who's a fan of science, comedy, scepticism, or funk. And let's face it, who isn't? Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. And Pseudopod will know it's over when they turn out the lights.